And it was written, two, three, 4 years ago. Maybe you picked it up. It was kind of a bestseller at the time. I'm going to sing another song. Okay. And it was titled The Worst Case Scenario Survival Handbook. Did you read that? It was so cool, man. It's just a little manual written in quite a factual tone, based on interviews with experts in a variety of fields. It reached a number one best-selling status as a nonfiction paperback book. It had just little chapters, little sections on things like how to escape from quicksand, how to jump from a building into a dumpster, how to perform a tracheotomy, things that most of us should really know how to do, you know. There's a whole chapter on how to perform an emergency tracheotomy on one of your friends if you should need to do that. All you need is a sharp razor blade, a very sharp knife, a ballpoint pen, and the ink removed from it. Sold millions of copies. Some of the advice is quite predictable, like in the part that has to do with how to deal with a charging bull. The number one rule in how to deal with a charging bull is not to antagonize the bull. I guess you don't say, you stupid bull. And I don't know what you do, but just don't antagonize the bull. And that seems fairly obvious. But sometimes the advice is quite demanding. Like there's a section called How to Survive If Your Parachute Fails to Open. First it says, signal to a jumping companion. This one is interesting because they don't say what to do if you're not jumping with a companion. But it says this, and I read from the book, it says, signal to a jumping companion whose chute is not yet open that you're having trouble. When your companion, who has now become your new best friend, gets to you, hook arms, you'll be falling at terminal velocity about 336 kilometers per hour. You open the chute. The chute opening shock will be severe, probably enough to dislocate or break your arms. You may hit the ground slowly enough to only break a leg, and your chances of survival are quite high. That's how you survive if your parachute fails to open. Now, I just want to do something before we start our study, since you have a little sense of what the book is really all about. I want to try a little test of your survival skills, all right? To see how ready we are here at Calvary Chapel Palm Springs, because you never know, all right? So this is right out of the book. You ready? What should you do if confronted by an angry mountain lion? Four possibilities. I should have put these on the screen. Number one, run. Number two, play dead. Number three, make yourself look bigger by opening your coat. Or number four, sing a gentle, happy song. Now, one of those is factual. Which of those four should you do if you're confronted by an angry mountain lion? And run, play dead, make yourself bigger by opening your coat, or sing a gentle, happy song. Don't tell me. Turn to the person next to you and tell them what you think, man. Okay? Tell them exactly what you think. How many of you said, sing a happy, gentle song? Huh? You were wrong. Believe it or not, the worst case scenario survival handbook is C, make yourself look bigger by opening your coat. Okay? Same situation. You're confronted by an angry mountain lion, but you have a child with you. What should you do? Pick the child up? Shield the child with your body? Shield your body with the child? Or run? See, if you run, you probably can't outrun the lion, but you could outrun the child. Okay. So which of those four do you think it is? Pick up the child, shield your body with the child, shield your child, the other thing that I didn't say, or run. Exactly right. like this is probably going to happen, but they say what you're supposed to do is pick up the child because it will make you look bigger. Open your coat, open the child's coat, anything to make you look bigger. This is what the author has to say. The principle behind this book is a simple one. You just never know, you never really know what life will throw at you, what is sitting around the corner. You never really know when you might be called upon to choose in a life or death situation. But when you are called, you need to know what to do. That's why the book was written. This morning, we are going to study together another kind of worst-case scenario and see how real-life people, ordinary people like you and me, responded, because you never know what curves life will throw at you when you're called to choose life or death. But when you are called, and you will be called, you need to know what to do. Daniel chapter 3, verse 1, let's pick it up there. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon, and King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, and the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image of the king of Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Let's just stop there for a moment. What I want to do this morning, I want to do something a little bit different. I've probably done this in different studies, maybe two or three times in the last 30 years. But what I kind of want to do, because as I was reading this and studying this, I thought maybe this would really be a way for us to understand what this is all about. And I really want to tell the ensuing story in chapter 3, first person, from the eyes of Daniel. What Daniel was kind of feeling. A lot of speculation, but we'll tell the story in that. So just kind of let your imagination now just kind of drift a little bit. And that's okay. You understand when you got saved, your imagination got saved too? Do you understand that? Everything about you got saved. It's okay. Okay, my thinker got saved, my doer got saved, my imaginator got saved. Everything about me got saved. So it's sanctified. So it's okay just to imagine a little bit, but we're going to tell the story from the perspective of Daniel. Let's just kind of see what happens. Whew. Does it seem hot in here to you? Does it feel as though the very fires of hell are about to burn you up? No, maybe not. Maybe it's just me. I've been all too close to a fire that you would not believe. A raging inferno, 7 times hotter than any normal fire had ever been. I've seen fire take lives right before my eyes, watch lives consumed. And what is worse, I have seen what awesome fires burn in the hearts of vengeful men. I have seen what pride that lies buried in the human heart will do. It will destroy. It will utterly destroy. Whew. I can just, even now this morning, feel the heat. I can smell the sickly smell of flesh incinerated. May I tell you what happened here, my friends, here in Babylon? Thank you. Let me first introduce myself. My name is Daniel. At least that's the name that my parents gave me in Judah. They named me Daniel, which means God is my judge. But you know, here in Babylon, they know me as Belteshazzar. When I was brought here, they changed my name. Well, maybe that's the place I need to begin to tell this story. I can hardly breathe, but you know, it's not only the fire that makes it hard to breathe. It's this smothering atmosphere. It's the air of oppression in which we live, the stench of absolute hatred. See, a man cannot breathe as God intended him to when the world is so polluted by pride. But I guess I'm ahead of myself. As I've said, let me go back. My name is Daniel. Only a few years ago, when I was very, very young, the Babylonians conquered Judah, my homeland. Well, many of us, my family included, were taken into exile. Well, there we hung up our harps and we wept because we did not know how we could possibly sing the Lord's songs of praise in such a strange land. Well, as I was growing up in this strange land, my father and my mother constantly talked about Jerusalem and about its great temple. But you know, all of it's in ruins now. It's been totally destroyed. We, the people of Judah, thought life had come to a total end. But one day, the word came that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, wanted some of the young men of Judah for his court. He wanted to train us for positions of responsibility. So me and three of my very close friends, we decided to go see what this was all about. My three friends were named Hananiah, Mishmael, and Azariah. With a mixture of excitement and fear, we entered the king's service and we began our training. We should have suspected something was very, very wrong, something was strange, when the first thing they did is they gave each and every one of us new names. What would have been wrong with letting us continue to just be Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah? Proud names these were, Hebrew names. Each of these names spoke of God. But we were told that no less than Nebuchadnezzar himself had decreed these new names on us. Belteshazzar for me, Shadrach for Hananiah, Meshach for Mishael, and Abednego for Azariah. I say, we should have suspected something was very, very wrong, for each of these names includes the names of Babylon's gods, Bel, Aku, and Nabo. See, we were most uncomfortable with our new names, but we accepted them anyway. Life goes on, you know. And it seemed as though taking new names was the path to opportunity. No reason to draw the line there. But you know what? They didn't stop at that point. They took us to the mess hall, and mess is right. Fatty foods, liquor. I'm telling you, the garbage they wanted to feed us. I decided right there and then that is where I was going to draw the line. I would serve the king. I would accept my new name. But I would not let my body go to ruin by eating and drinking away my health. So I refused. So did my three friends. We refused to participate in this defilement. After all, there are just some things not worth your very life. If Babylon wanted strong men to serve their king, well, we would show them what real strong men were made of. So we would eat the way that we were trained. They backed down, and we, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and I, we all ended our training in superb condition, better than anybody else. And we all got places preferred at Nebuchadnezzar's court. You see, you must draw the line. Listen to me now. You must draw the line against the indulgent ways of the world. And you must draw it early or it will take you over if you don't draw that line quickly. So we did. One fateful night, this king had a dream. A very bad dream, a vicious nightmare. He had dreamed about a great image, a statue made of various metals but with feet of clay. That worried the king. Nebuchadnezzar had a vague feeling that something was wrong. He demanded from his kingdom that someone come and interpret this dream. The wise men came from his kingdom, and none of these wise men from Babylon could interpret this dream. They did not know what this dream meant. Or maybe it was that none of them would tell him because of fear. I rather suspect maybe that they knew, but they were afraid to say. Think about it. a great image, a statue made of many metals, but with feet of clay? Was it hard to figure out what Nebuchadnezzar had dreamt about? And so I went to his majesty, and I said, "Sir, I can interpret your dream for you." He said, "Continue." I said, "Well, the dream means that, your majesty, you are a mighty king, ruling over an empire, a great empire of many peoples, many nations, many languages. But, sir, you have feet of clay. That means that you are not founded. You do not stand on anything firm and certain. So the day of reckoning will come for Babylon as it has for every nation that ever was and ever will be." I just told Nebuchadnezzar that his kingdom was not infinite. That's all. And he thought it was, and I told him the truth. Well, I want to tell you this morning, the king's reaction was absolutely astounding. On the one hand, he was absolutely elated, excited to find out that the dream affirmed his work of nation building. He was most gratified to know that all that he had done for years in building Babylon was acknowledged by God as successful. And he was puffed up and so excited that God acknowledged that all he had done had accomplished what he had intended it to do. The king, like most of us, needed to know at his time of life that he had not wasted his energies on a fly-by-night illusion. That what he had done with purpose, and it was successful, and he was excited about hearing that. And yet, as I've said, that was only one side of the story. Yes, he was elated to know that Babylon was a great empire, made of many nations, many peoples, many languages. But on the other hand, Nebuchadnezzar was immensely threatened by their prediction that it would all come down. He could not stand the thought that his work of many years had feet of clay. Nor would he admit that because Babylon had saved up its wealth, hoarded it, instead of using it for mercy to the poor, it was vulnerable. So Nebuchadnezzar had to make a decision. So what did he do? Well, first of all, he threw a fit. It was incredible. He went into royal overdrive, I'll call it, man. He decided he was going to force his power on everyone. See, instead of remedying the flaws, which he could have done when he received the interpretation of the dream, instead of remedying his flaws, instead of cultivating the people's loyalty, Nebuchadnezzar set up this great golden image, a likeness of himself, out in the plain of Dura, and commanded that everyone bow down, worship this image, or else. And they must do it. No other loyalties. No other gods, no other ideas, absolutely no other allegiances. Either you worship Babylon, Babylon's gods, and Babylon's king, or you die. Either you buy into this nation's love of wealth and power, or you are not welcome here. I believe in your time you call that denial. You just don't want to hear the truth. So you make everybody tell you lies that you want to hear. That's denial. I really don't have a problem in this area. I could quit this anytime I want to. I really don't have a hang up here. I could stop this. It's not a problem for me. And then we surround ourselves with people. You surround yourself with people that say, yeah, it's okay. You'll be fine. It's not a problem. Just be yourself. And it's denial. That's exactly what the king was going through. Now, who will speak the truth to such a person as that? Who will say no to the powerful? Who will speak the truth and love to those who bluster and brag and brazenly make everything a matter of satisfying their own ego, a matter of self-congratulations? My friends and I settled on a strategy. We decided that we could remain faithful in the shadows. Shadrach suggested that we just do our jobs, stay out of the way, and if we did our jobs well, no one would really care or notice that we did not worship at Dura. Meshach added that he thought we could quietly build friendships at the court, and if something ever did come down, then those alliances would protect us. Abednego mentioned the fact that there were many people of Judah in the kingdom, that certainly they would not kill us because they were friends of ours. As for me, Daniel, my counsel was that we pray and pray and pray some more, that we trust God should the day of trial come. See, in my experience, God has not promised skies always blue. God has not always promised clouds without rain. But God has promised his love and his presence. He told Joshua of old, I will not fail you nor forsake you. Well, together, my three friends and I agreed that we would be quiet, we would be effective, we would be connected, and we would be faithful. We believe that just as before, when we were in training and we were pushed to eat and drink things that we knew would harm us and we drew the line, they would respect us this time as they did that time. Not a problem. Little did we know how threatened people would react. They were threatened. Little did we understand that danger comes not from so much from those who actually have power as it does from those who want power and will do absolute anything to hold that power. Little men who want to be big, but who only know one way to have what they want, and that is to tear others down. Well, a cabal of brazen Babylonians reported to their king that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had not bowed down their knees to the image of Dura, but had continued to pray to the God of Israel. Somehow, I don't know why or how, my name was not mentioned. But my friends were denounced, and before I could gather my wits to defend them, they were on trial. And let me tell you, trials in Babylon of those considered to be traitors are swift and sure. There is no court procedure to speak of, and there is no appeal of the king's decision. The best I could do was to lean out of my window at the palace and look out over the courtyards while that so-called trial took place. You know, a cold shudder just ran through me as I heard this order from the king. Heat up the furnace, heat it 7 times its normal heat, and throw them in, these traitors. Throw them in and do it now. I allow no one to ever defy me. I was horrified. Not only for the fate of my friends, but also because I saw just how evil the human heart can be. I saw that when we center the whole world on ourselves and our fragile egos, we lash out and bring down others with us in the name of justice. But you know, it isn't justice at all. It's egomania. It's pride. It's idolatry. from the beginning when Cain killed Abel until now, it's always been the same. When power comes, power corrupts, and it corrupts absolutely. Success. When people experience just a little bit of success, they idolize themselves and they lash out against anybody who challenges them. Oh, good people, look at King Nebuchadnezzar and be warned. This could be your end. This could be you in your capital city, looking successful but spiritually empty. Building Babylon, but buying bankruptcy. You know, my heart shuddered. But oh, my friends, my dear friends, still dressed in their official uniforms, with tunic and trousers and turban, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were bound tightly, and shoulders bundled them off toward the furnace. By that time, the flames were leaping high out of the top of the oven, more than 70 feet up into the air. I had never seen such a blaze in my life. I wanted to scream, but by now the heat was so intense, I could feel it all the way across the courtyard, at my window, and my throat was even parched. I could not speak, but I could pray. Oh, how I could pray. I prayed for the God of Israel to see those faithful hearts. I prayed for my friends that they might be spared, though I could not see in any way. At this last moment, I even prayed, as hard as it was to do for Nebuchadnezzar, that like Pharaoh of old, his hardened heart might be softened for just a little while. I prayed because there is nothing else you can do. You can pray. I prayed because I ought to have been praying from the very beginning of this trial. I prayed because my call as a faithful man is to pray without ceasing, to pray in season, to pray out of season, to pray in the Spirit at all times, to pray. Without prayer, nothing of value will ever happen. With prayer, there is an open line to God Himself, that He may hear and He may save. I prayed. The soldiers and my friends nearing the gaping mouth of the furnace. It was so hot that none dared approach it. But the king in his rage shouted all the more for blood, "Throw them in! Throw them in now, I say!" I heard afterwards that just before this happened, my three friends uttered something like this, and they said, "Our God will save us. But if not, if He does not, we will still not bow down to your idols and your gods of this world." Do you know, as the king shouted that, "Throw them in now," do you know it was so hot that when the soldiers obeyed Nebuchadnezzar's order, they themselves were overcome by the heat and they immediately died? In fact, a whole contingent of soldiers died trying to do their misguided duty. And Nebuchadnezzar, he just laughed at all these soldiers dying. See, life is cheap when you think you are the only one worth anything. The blaze roared as my friends went into the flames. For a while, I could not see anything, as the intensity of the fire made a light so bright my eyes were blinded. But when I was able to see, I saw the king peering into the flames. For the longest time, he was staring into the furnace. And then I discovered why. Because from across the courtyard, I could now see what he saw. I saw, believe it or not, I saw four figures in this fiery furnace walking around in the flames. Four, not three, but four. And my first thought was, how could anybody still be alive in that fire? And where in the world did this fourth guy come from? Who was he? I didn't see anybody enter the furnace with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Unknown to them or to the soldiers, could somebody have entered in? Who would have done such a thing? I cannot tell you, and yet I can. I cannot give you his name, but I have enough to know, and I saw enough to know that this fourth person in the flames was in some way God himself. How he did it, I cannot say. But I can say, in some way, it was very God himself, the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of eternity, stepped into those flames, and he bore in his own body the pain and the hurt that was meant for my friends. And he saved them. He saved them. How can it be? How can it be that the great God himself, deserving no punishment, eternal in the heavens, should come down here in human form and enter the fiery furnace with the likes of us? How can that be? I don't know. With all of my wisdom, I don't know. And yet this I do know. I, Daniel, stand before you to testify to one great truth. You know, here in Babylon, we've learned a new skill. It's called mathematics. Here I have learned how to use numbers to add, to multiply, to subtract, and divide. It started right here in Babylon, and I learned it. It's a wonderful skill, but I have learned one great truth that no Babylon has in his copybooks. One great equation that no wise man has ever computed before. That 3 plus 1 equals what? You say 4? You would think so. But 3 plus 1 equal 4? No. I have learned that with God, 3 plus 1 equals infinity. 3 men plus 1 God equals infinity. A people like my Judah, or a people like you, gathered here this morning, if you will pray and continually seek the presence of the will of God, you are victors. Even though you may be strangers in an alien land, an alien place, with God, I want to tell you this morning, all things are possible. For with God in the equation, 3 plus 1 equals infinity. I have also learned that faithfulness, hear me, learn this truth, faithfulness is its own reward. I have learned that this world will rage at you if you dare to be different. If you choose to indulge in luxury and self-gratification, this world will embrace and applaud you. They want believers to give themselves to the idols of money and comfort, rich food and strong drink. They want you to do that because if you do that, then they can point their fingers at you and say, you are no different than the rest of us. And they will be most upset if instead of spending money on more things, you give it to God's work. They will be very unhappy if instead of hanging out at their happy hours, you pursue happiness in Bible study groups or ministry teams. They will say all sorts of unkind things about you. Why? Because they are threatened. But I have learned that you do not need the world's approval. You do not need to fit into the world's way of life. You have the approval of God himself. You want to fit into the kingdom way of life. For in the kingdom, the mathematics favor you. No matter how many out in the world put you down, I want to tell you, you are on the winning side, for 3 plus 1 equals infinity. And finally, I have learned And I have my three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as witnesses, that when you go through fiery trials, you are not alone. When temptation rages, when the critics cry out against you, when enemies attack and criticize and try to bring you into their mold, I am here to tell you this morning, there is a flood of cooling water that will put out the most ardent fire. When you go through that fiery trial, remember your baptism. For there, God declared you His own. You are His. And nothing can pluck you out of His hand. Be of good courage. He will strengthen your heart. He is Emmanuel. He is God with us. He suffers right there alongside of us. But He is unharmed. He is risen from the dead. He is mighty to save. 3 + 1 = what now? Infinity, eternity, alive forever with Him. And the day came for him once in the garden when Jesus himself, the Son of God, said, Father, let this cup pass from me. Do not make me go through this thing. Spare me this ultimate suffering. You are able, Father, you are able. But then he said, not my will, but yours be done, Father. You're able to spare me. But even if you do not, I will not turn away. I will drink this cup to the very last drop. On the cross, the Son of God says of his Father, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. God is able. God is infinitely good. He showers us with gifts of joy. Guess I'm asking you this morning, as your pastor, for you to decide. Even when he doesn't, will you be a devoted follower? Even when things don't happen the way you want them to, will you be his child? Are you following me? That's the important message. It is easy to follow him when everything is going well. And we're praising him for his goodness and his greatness. But what happens when we're in front of the fiery furnace and we've sought him and we've had our prayer times and we've had people pray for us and we've gathered in faith and we've trusted God? And we know we're not going in that fire because everything's going to be okay. What happens when we're thrown into that furnace? Will we still follow him, church? See, the popular teaching today is it's going to be wonderful every day of your life. If you have enough faith, you'll have no problems. That's not what the Bible teaches. Though he slay me, yet I will follow him. Because he's given me eternity. He's paid the price. It's not that this Christian life isn't great, it is. But it's great not because we are exempt from all the problems. It's great because through the problems, he walks with us. He's there with us. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. I love that verse because I discovered just a couple of 3 years ago, I saw it for the first time. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, shadow precludes light. You can't have a shadow without light. And yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, he's with me. He is with me, so there is light. Though he slay me, yet I will follow him. Because God knows what's right. Don't follow him for what he can do for you. I can't tell you how many people I've talked to over the years. And they're at a broken time in their life. And they're expecting God to fix the brokenness. To heal the situation. To give them the job back. To give them the spouse back. To give them the kids back. To give them their health back. And my counsel always has to be, if that never happens, will you still follow Jesus? Because that's the gospel truth. But when you go through that, the good news is, he'll be there with you. He'll walk it through with you. Stand with me, would you please? You need to know I'm through. Just bow your heads with me, would you? Just, I want you to reflect for a few moments in prayer. That's all. I'm just going to ask you to spend a couple of moments in talking to God. Just bow your heads, and I want to ask you to reflect on this for a few moments. Is there anywhere in your life where you have been holding back full devotion? Anywhere? In a relationship? In choices, in decisions, in your life, is there any place at all you've been holding back full devotion? By that I mean that you're not going full on with God because you think it's going to cost you something. Is there any place at all, man? Then think about this. Is there any place where fear or disappointment or hurt or sin has been keeping you from following him with total reliance and complete total trust? Is there any place at all? I'd like to ask you now to decide and pray, just in your heart. Even if he does not, I will be a fully devoted follower. Just pray that in your heart if you can. This is what it means to be a believer. Even if he does not, I will be a fully devoted follower. You decide. You talk it over with God. Lord Jesus, I ask that you would deal with our hearts. Lord, so many of us, we trust you as long as we're the cream of the crop in the kingdom, like Daniel and his three buddies. They were respected. They were the healthiest. They were the places of honor in the court, but they still followed you, Lord. But then the time came when they had to make a decision to follow you. Or to follow the gods of the world. And they chose to follow you. And they made a declaration that even if you did not, they still would follow you. And Lord, they discovered a relationship with you in that decision they never had before. A nearness, a closeness, a reality of your presence that was so real, God. And Lord, that's what we want. That's truly what we want. And we thank you, Jesus. I've decided to follow Jesus, just a cappella. Can you do that? You want me to do it? I just want you to sing this and just sing it from your heart, man. Sing it like you mean it, maybe for the first time. I have decided to follow Jesus. No turning back. No turning back.
To follow Jesus.